Hare Krishna. So we continue our discussion of churning the ocean, the Bhagavatam and the heart. Yesterday we discussed about the pastime of churning the milk ocean, and we came to the point where the devatas and the asuras have agreed to together churn the ocean. So they all went, took the Mandara Parvat, the giant mountain, and they lifted it. Now, today with our skeptical, logical mind, we may think, how can a mountain be lifted? Actually, the important point to recognize in such situations is that possibility is a matter of scale. Now, if there's a glass on the table in front of me, and if an ant is moving along the table, for the ant, moving that glass may seem to be impossible. For the ant, the glass may seem like a mountain. So, that's why possibility is dependent on proportion. And that's why we shouldn't extrapolate from our proportion what is possible and what is impossible. So, these are empirically impossible for us, like lifting up mountains, but they are possible in principle if there is adequate strength. So the demigods and demons have far more strength than we have, and that's how they can even lift mountains. Then they started lifting the mountain jubilantly and marching along, but they got exhausted. They had to take the mountain, the Mandara mountain. It is described in the cosmology of the Bhagavatam in the 5th canto, that it is tall, it is very long, and although it is giant, but it is shaped so that it can be used as a churning rod. So they were carrying the mountain along, but its huge size and giant weight became unbearable, and it started crushing them, and they started falling down. And as they were in great pain, being crushed by the weight of the mountain, they didn't know what to do. The demons were simply agonizing in pain, but the devatas again called to the Supreme Lord for help. And the Lord came along, flying on Garuda, and he just picked up the Mandara mountain with one hand. Just as Krishna lifted up Govardhan with not just one hand, but with one finger of one hand. Not just any finger, the smallest finger. And according to our acharyas, it was not even the finger that lifted up Govardhan, it was the nail on the finger that lifted up Govardhan. So, Krishna, similarly Lord Vishnu here came along and lifted up the mountain effortlessly with one hand. So, miracles are not against science, they are above science. Against science means unscientific, where above science means trans-scientific. Science mostly studies things which are in our experience, and it tries to extrapolate based on the observations that we have made to general inferences or principles. But science cannot talk much about things which are beyond our observation and so beyond our inference also. So science mostly studies the gross material realm. There are three levels of reality: gross matter, subtle matter and spirit. So science mostly studies gross matter, and that's why subtle matter and spirit are not against science, but they are above science. So the Lord has spiritual energy, and by that spiritual energy, he not only has spiritual energy, but he also has supreme energy, because he's omnipotent. So he can do anything, and God's doing things which seem like miracles to us, like lifting up mountains, that is not against science, that is above science. So Lord Vishnu lifted up the mountain and then placed it on his carrier Garuda. So not only could the Lord lift up the mountain, but even Garuda could lift up the mountain. We see that Krishna lifted up Govardhan and Hanuman carried a mountain. Hanuman carried a part of the Himalayan mountain range, a mountain which carried the herbal medicines, and he carried all across the Indian subcontinent from the Himalayas to Sri Lanka. So, similarly, Garuda is an empowered devotee, and he could also carry Mandara mountain. And the Lord also sat on Garuda, and both of them they flew with Mandara next to the Lord on the back of Garuda, and they reached the milk ocean. Now, it's important to understand when we talk of the milk ocean, Shweta Sagara. Yes, it is a milk ocean, but it is existing in higher levels of reality. It is in the higher areas of the cosmos. And because of that, because of being in the higher areas of the cosmos, it is of a different nature. So in this, we know that in the heavenly planets, the bodies are also made of subtler elements. That's why when the devatas come here, they can come to the world, and unless they give the power, we cannot see the devatas, because their bodies are made of subtler matter. So similarly, when we talk about milk ocean, the milk is not the same as the milk we have on this planet. In this world, everything is gross. But in the higher planets, things are subtle. So when the devatas eat food, their food is also subtle. So, like that, it's a Shweta Sagar. It's an ocean of milk. And it's huge. So the plan was, what the Lord had outlined, that they get the mountain will have some herbs in it, and they were also told to get other herbs, and when the herbs were mixed, to be mixed with milk, and then the mixture was to be churned. So by that churning of the various herbs with the milk was going to be transformed into nectar. Nectar was eventually going to emerge from it. So there was a transformation and an emergence that was going to happen. Now, before this whole pastimes action had started, when the Lord was talking with the devatas headed by Brahma along with Indra. So Brahma is the, like the, as I said, the Brahmana, the advisor of the gods. And Indra is the functional head. He is the person who rules and who commands in warfare. Who is the king, basically. Kartikeya is the functional commander. And Indra is the king of the gods. So, while talking with them, Lord Vishnu had told Indra that it is by violence you cannot solve things easily. No, but by patience and tolerance you can solve problems. So, therefore, when you are dealing with the demons, don't get angry if they make any proposals, agree with whatever they are saying and move forward with your plan. So this was the plan of that the Lord had outlined, and accordingly everyone started out. So here the Lord had told them that don't have any quarrel with the demons. So finally they had come to the milk ocean, they had brought the Mandara mountain. And now, when churning is to be done, say when in traditional home settings, mothers would churn, the mothers or the housewives would churn butter and churn to make butter or eventually ghee. So then they would have a churning rod, and that churning rod could be moved with the hands. But what to do when there's a huge mountain? How do we churn that? So they needed a rope. The rope would go around it, and any ordinary rope would just get worn out by the power of the friction. So they decided that they needed a more powerful rope, and that they decided was the serpent Vasuki. Now, there are in the Bhagavad Gita, if we read the 10th chapter Vibhuti Yoga, so Krishna talks about Sarpanam, among Sarpas he says, I am Vasuki, and among Nagas I am Ananta. So what is the difference between Sarpa and Naga? Naga is basically a hooded serpent. It's like Kaliya was a hooded serpent. So Nagana Anantaschasmi. So not all serpents have hoods. Just like not all serpents are poisonous. So similarly, not all serpents are hooded. So those which have hoods are called as Nagas. And some Nagas have also multiple hoods. So now Vasuki was a serpent, a very powerful serpent. In fact, he's considered the king of the serpents. So he was told that let your body serve as a rope. Now nobody will do anything for free. He said, why should I undergo this trouble of letting my body be ground like this, undergo the friction? So they told him that we will also give you a share of the nectar. And then I'm hearing this, Vasuki also became happy. So everybody wants to live as long as possible, and everybody wants to do whatever is possible to prolong life. And that is something which is a very strong, that longing for immortality is a very strong indicator of our immortal nature, of our spiritual nature. Now, atheists find it very difficult to explain that if we are just material creatures and matter is by its very nature temporary, and we who are just products of matter, why should we have the urge to live for long? Why should we have the urge to live forever? None of us want to die, and even Darwin's theory of evolution is based on the concept that everyone wants to survive, but the fittest will survive. Survival of the fittest. So why is it that we want to survive at all? Where, if everything is temporary, by its very nature temporary, then, and that's how it has been for all time since the world was created, then how did the urge for living forever come into the human mind? You know, we can't just imagine something which has no connection with anything that we ever experienced. So, our very innate longing for immortality, which is so directly in contrast with the nature of everything that we see around us, indicates that we don't belong to the nature that is around us, that we are of a different nature. Now, if we are in a house where we see that everything is made up of stone, there are bricks or slabs or concrete, and then suddenly we see a gold pebble lying over there, you'll wonder, hey, where has this gold pebble come from? That its nature is so dramatically different from the nature of everything around it, that the question will come up naturally, insistently, where is this gold come from? It is not from here, it must be from somewhere else. Is there some gold mine or maybe gold shop? Or some treasury with gold over there. So similarly, when we see that everything around us is temporary, and we have the longing for immortality, longing for eternity, where does this come from? That means there must be some part within us which is immortal. And from that part within us, our longing for immortality is coming. And that is not just a part within us. When we study the Vedic philosophy systematically, we understand it is not just a part, it is actually essentially who we are. That is the soul. The soul is immortal, and the soul presently has got a material body and is identifying with that material body. But still, the soul's innate longing for eternal existence, which is naturally fulfilled at the spiritual level, the soul is now trying to fulfill at the material level. So that's how we understand, we infer from our longing for immortality, our spiritual nature, which is actually immortal. So Vasuki also agreed to become a rope so that he would get the share of the nectar after it was churned. And then the demigods and demons started churning. So Lord Vishnu had also come with the devatas, and he led the devatas, and they went to the head of the serpent. And they grabbed the head side. And the demons, they were told to go towards the tail side. So at this point, the demons objected. Their idea was that, you know, we are also powerful, we are also knowledgeable, we are also heroic. And in fact, their thinking was that at this point, we have defeated you. It is you who came to us for a truce. So why should we be given the tail part? We want the head part. So Lord Vishnu saw the rebellious expressions on the faces of the demons, and he smiled, and he put down the head part and quietly went to the tail part of the serpent. And the demigods also followed without any objection. And the demons immediately went happily, proudly to the head part and took up that part, and they started churning. And as they started churning, the churning went on very fiercely. Several things happened, but I'll complete this analysis before coming back to the events. So when the churning went on for a long time, then now there was poison and poisonous substance in the belly of the serpent, and that poisonous substance started coming out of its mouth, and as it was coming out, those noxious fumes, they started choking the demons, and they started, their eyes started tearing up, they started coughing and grasping their stomachs and their chests, and they became miserable. And the demigods looked at Lord Vishnu and they started smiling with each other. So actually the demons demanded something as their right, and eventually when they got the right, they found that it was all wrong, that actually they got the worst part of the deal. So actually in this world, everybody is very interested in rights. You know, this is my right, this is my right, this is my right. But often in the demand, in the struggle, in the conflict for rights, people often end up doing something which only creates trouble for them. So this doesn't mean that there are not basic human rights which have to be given to everyone, but all of us have a position, and as by constitution we are parts. Mama yamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatanaha. So by constitution we are parts, and therefore by constitution our role is contribution. By constitution our role is contribution. So every day I write an article on the Bhagavad Gita on my site, the GitaDaily.com. So recently I wrote an article, live not for gratification, live for contribution. So gratification means one's own pleasure, contribution means contributing to the whole. So the Lord is the knower of the whole, and He knows what role we can play the best. And when we take up that role and we play that role efficiently, then we contribute in a way that is the best for us and the best for the whole. So, and the demons, they did not want to accept the role which the Lord had given them. And what happened was, they themselves got into trouble because of that. Living beings, we are meant to be controllers, but we are meant to be controllers in assistance to the supreme control of the Lord. If we consider the hierarchy, there are three fundamental components or three fundamental aspects which are studied in the Upanishads. So these tattva, they are called tattvatraya. Tattva is truth and traya is three. Tattvatraya is Jagadish, Jiva and Jagat. So Jagadish is the supreme Lord. Jiva is the living entity, and Jagat is the universe. And these three tattvas are discussed especially in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Among all the chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, the 13th chapter is the most Upanishadic. It resembles the Upanishads both in its style, in the kind of verses that are there, in its content, the kind of profound enigmatic statements that are there, that I am inside everything, I am outside everything also. Bahirantascha bhutanam acharam charameva cha. So it is said that absolute truth is inside everything, outside everything also. So that sort of enigmatic statements are there. The 13th chapter is the most Upanishadic in the Bhagavad Gita. And the 13th chapter is appropriately titled by Srila Prabhupada as Nature, the Enjoyer and Consciousness. So these three refer to the three tattvas, tattvatraya. Nature is Jagat. The Enjoyer is Jagadish. And consciousness is the jiva. So these three tattvas are there in the universe, and we, our position in the hierarchy is that it's intermediate. We are above Jagat and we are below Jagadish. So we can control the Jagat to some extent. So we have a body and we can decide, okay, I want to go here, I want to go there, I want to speak this, I want to eat this. We have some control, but we don't have complete control. We can't, even if we desire suddenly, we can't start flying in the sky. We can walk on the earth. So we have control, but it is limited control. Now, the best way that the jiva can use its capacity to control the Jagat is by acting according to the will of Jagadish. So this, you know, the same senses which are the cause of bondage can also become the source of liberation if they are used in the service of Krishna. That's why we see so many times in the prayers of the devotees, they are talking about how we want to use our senses in your service. So the same eyes which can get attracted to sense objects and cause bondage, those eyes we can use to take darshan of the Lord. So in the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, this is how it is described. Ambarish Maharaj engaged all his senses. So it's a long series of verses. Savai Manah Krishna Padar Vindayor Vachamsu Vaikanta Guna Nuvarnane. So like that it goes on. He used his mind to think of the Lord, his power of speech to glorify the Lord. And Hastau Cha Karmasu, he used his hand to do seva for the Lord. Padau Hare Kshetra Padanu Sarpane, he used his lotus feet to go towards the temple and the dhams of the Lord. And then he used his Ghranam Cha Tatpada Saroja Saurabe, he used his nose to smell the flowers and the tulsi that is offered to the Lord. So like that, the same senses which cause bondage can also bring about liberation if they are used in the service of the Lord. So the important thing for all of us is to act according to our position. So the demons wanted to take up something which was different from the position that the Lord had allocated them. And what happened thereby was, they got into greater trouble. So when the jiva tries to become an independent enjoyer, then the jiva gets into a lot of trouble. Now coming back, as they had started churning, the demons at using the head of Vasuki and the devatas at the tail of the Vasuki, they started pulling, and as they were churning, now the Mandar mountain was so heavy that both the demons and demigods were pulling, and the purpose of pulling was to churn, but the churning rod should not slip out of the hand of the person who is churning. The churning rod has to be held and then it can be moved and it will churn. But the Mandar mountain started slipping from their grip. And as it started slipping from their grip, then the demigods started panicking. The demigods and demons, both the churning party, started panicking. Because if that mountain went into the ocean and disappeared, how would they find it? And even if they found it, how would they lift it back? So as they were panicking, immediately the Lord appeared in another manifestation. So the Lord was already there, churning along with the devatas, but the Lord manifested as Kurmadev, as the tortoise incarnation. And he went underneath and he let the the mountain rest on his back. Now tortoises have very hard backs. They are like the shells and they withdraw themselves into the shell to protect themselves. So the Lord took up this tortoise form, and through this tortoise form he sheltered the mountain. Now it's significant that the Vedic scriptures talk about God in multifarious forms. Some people say that, some skeptics say that the concept of a personal God is simply the anthropomorphic imagination of some people. Anthropomorphic means anthropa is human and morphos is form. So because we humans have a particular form, we have imagined God in that form. So they say this is just the concept of a personal God. You worship God with two hands, two legs, and attributes like a human being. So that is simply the anthropomorphic projection of the human imagination. However, the argument can go cut other way also. The sword can cut both ways. Now, we could also say that human beings, the Bible also says that man is made in the image of God. So it is not that God is anthropomorphic, rather we are theomorphic. Theomorphic means we are made in the image of God. Theos is God, morphos is form. So our form is made based on the form of God. And apart from that, another point is the concept of God as a human being is not the only concept of God that is given in the Vedic literature. So the Vedic literature describes God in various forms. So God comes as a half man, half lion. He comes as a boar. He comes as a fish. He comes as a tortoise. So now, if it's just, if the concept of God is imagination, then God is a tortoise. Is that the imagination of the tortoises? No, the tortoise is not written in the scriptures. Even from the skeptical point of view, even if they don't accept that the scriptures are revelations coming from God through his exalted sages, still, nobody can claim that it's come from tortoises, it's come from human beings. So the very fact that the Vedic scriptures talk about God in so many different forms, that indicates that the Vedic scriptures are not talking about a God that is a product of anthropomorphic imagination. And you know, there is, just like there are so many isms, there is communism, there is capitalism, there is nationalism. So similarly, there is something called a speciesism. Speciesism means my species is special. So the human species is special. So this is actually the Judeo-Christian conception that only human beings have souls. Other living beings, they consider they don't have any souls at all. So this is actually not stated in the Bible. The Bible also says nefresh, it uses the word. The Old Testament uses the word to refer, and nefresh means soul, living soul. It uses it for animals also. But somehow, some Christian theologians have come up with the idea that the kind of souls that are present in humans are different from the souls that are present in animals and plants. And only human souls have the capacity for immortality. And animal and plant souls don't have the capacity for immortality. So for all practical purposes, they are not actually souls at all. They don't have souls in the sense of the word souls, of being spiritual and eternal. So this is an erroneous conception. And the point is, we are talking about speciesism. Speciesism means sectarianism based on the idea of my species is special. So is the human species special? Yes, it is special in the sense that the human form provides a special opportunity for the soul that is not available in other forms. That is the opportunity for self-realization. But it is not that only human beings have souls. Even animals have souls. Even plants have souls. And the souls evolve from the lower species to the higher species. And even in those species also, God manifests. And that is the amazingly ecumenical. Ecumenical means inclusive. Democratic nature of God. That he manifests in all species. And he lets all species... we are attracted to different species. People go to zoos and to circuses to see animals. People make documentaries about wildlife and see those documentaries. So, whatever it is that we are attracted to in this world, Krishna arranges so that we can channelize that attraction towards him. So, he manifests even in animal form. So, he manifested here as Kurma Avatar. And now, if a giant mountain is coming on the back of someone, that person will consider it a great tragedy. It will consider a horror. That may be the way somebody might meet a torturous death. But for Lord Kurmadev, it was just a tickle. It was a very pleasant tickle. Sometimes when the back is itching and we are not able to reach our hand doesn't go to our back. So, we ask somebody else, scratch that back a little bit. So, now the Lord was allowing the demons and the devatas to do service to him. Now, he doesn't have any scratch and he doesn't have any itch and he doesn't need to scratch. But as we discussed earlier, Leela, Tallilaya, for the purpose of pastime, the Lord performs this so that he gains pleasure and he gives service and gives opportunity for spiritual advancement to others. So, Kurmadev became the platform on which the Mandara Parvat, as the churning rod, rested, and then they started churning it vigorously. And as they were churning it vigorously, another problem came up that the rod started getting vertically imbalanced. It started falling off. The one problem could be the rod will sink. The other problem could be the rod can fall off. And again, the rod was so giant that to hold it up aloft, hold it vertical, became a big challenge. And as the demigods and demons were struggling, sweating, slaving, so they started panicking. And then the Lord manifested another form as Ananta. And he came above, and he held the churning rod from above with his many arms. And in this way, the Lord was above, the Lord was below, and the Lord was next to the mountain. So the Lord was actually doing everything. And it is described further, the effort of churning started exerting and hurting everyone. So then the Lord entered into all the participants in different modes. The demigods, the Lord entered as the mode of goodness and energized them thereof. And he entered into the demons in the mode of passion and he energized them thereof. And he entered into Vasuki in the mode of ignorance, as the mode of ignorance, not in, as the mode of ignorance. And he put him off to sleep. You know, if something is troubling a lot, if a person is in a lot of pain, and the pain is neither curable nor tolerable, then what is the solution? Many times doctors give sedatives. Just put the person to sleep. So, there is a natural sedative and that is the mode of ignorance. That's how all of us are able to sleep. When this mode of ignorance comes upon us, actually, sleep itself is a mystery and a miracle. We don't think of it that way, but sometimes when we try to sleep and we are not able to sleep, we can realize that actually sleep is not in my control. Often we realize that sleep is not in my control in the opposite situation. We may not want to sleep and we fall asleep. We want to chant attentively but suddenly we nod off. Then also we realize our sleeping is not in my control. But even when sometimes it happens that some people suffer from insomnia. So they're just not able to sleep even when they want to. So even sleeping is not in our power. Because the act of sleeping involves a switching of our consciousness. Our consciousness, our means the consciousness of the embodied soul, goes through three different stages. That is Jagruti, which is the level in which we are right now. Then there is Swapna, which is sleep stage. And Sushupti is deep dreamless sleep. So the soul's consciousness, when it is rooted through the gross body to the outer world, that is the Jagruti stage. When the soul's consciousness is withdrawn into the subtle body, but not expressed into the gross body, then that is the Swapna stage. And the soul's consciousness is so deeply withdrawn that it is not there even in the subtle body, then that is the Sushupti stage, that is the deep dreamless sleep. So, now switching from Jagruti to Swapna, that means withdrawing the consciousness from the gross matter and letting it be present only in the subtle matter, that is not in our power. It is the super soul who switches off the switch. So every night when we go to sleep, we can thank God for whatever happened in the day. But we also need to thank God for the sleep that we get. Because without His mercy, without He turning the switch, we can't go from Jagruti to Swapna. So there is the natural sedative in the form of the mode of ignorance that comes by the arrangement of the Lord. And that allows us to rest and recuperate. So, this natural sedative in the form of ignorance entered Vasuki and he went to sleep. Now, it's interesting that both the demons and the devatas were exerting themselves. And both were exerting themselves vigorously. But still, when both were exerting themselves vigorously, it is said that the demons were energized by the mode of passion. And the devatas were energized by the mode of goodness. So, how is it that the same kind of demanding work could be done by both, but while being animated by different modes? Sometimes some people think if one is in goodness, then one will have to become very calm, very, very almost like passive. No, a person in goodness is also very active. But a person in goodness is thoughtfully active. A person in passion is often impulsively active, thoughtlessly active. And now the three modes, if you want to understand, we can say, we can phrase it in a humorous way as Some people make things happen, some people watch things happen, and some people wonder what happened. So, some people make things happen, they are in the mode of goodness. Some people watch things happen, they are in the mode of passion. Now, they want things to happen, and they start things, but then things go out of control, and they know, oh, this went wrong, that went wrong, oh, this went there, that went there. So, they watch things happen, what is happening? And then the people who are in ignorance, some people wonder, what happened? What's all this happening around me? So, these are typical of the three modes. So, actually, goodness and passion both involve activity. A person in goodness is also active. Person in passion is also active. In fact, the person in goodness may not be running around frantically as a person in the mode of passion is. But the person in goodness can also be doing as much activity and can do it more productively and more intelligently. So, when we practice spiritual life, it is not that we have to do less activity. Of course, we can give up doing unnecessary activities, but devotees are also busy. We see Srila Prabhupada would sleep just for a few hours at night and work so vigorously. And why was he working so vigorously? Because he wanted to serve Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport of 6.17 in the Bhagavad Gita, Yuktahara Viharasya, that a devotee cannot tolerate sleeping for one moment more than necessary because the devotee wants to do so much service for Krishna. So it's very, very poignant phrasing. Poignant means very emotionally stirring phrasing that a devotee cannot tolerate sleeping more than necessary. A devotee feels that, oh, there's so much to do, how can I sleep? So devotees are also active, but they are active for Krishna's service. So, sometimes when we feel that I have so many things to do, how can I manage time for my spiritual life? How can I manage time for chanting, for studying scripture, for associating with devotees? There are so many things to do. Yes, there are a lot of things to do, but we also need to know that just having a lot of time doesn't necessarily translate into doing a lot of things. Because often, when there are a lot of things to do, the things cause all those things, when they are just thoughts about them are running around in the mind, those thoughts cause stress and friction. I have to do this also, I have to do this also, I have to do that also, I have to do that also. And we know in any machine when there is friction, the friction wastes energy internally and therefore not much the productivity outside gets decreased by that. So similarly, when we are in the mode of passion, what happens is there's a lot of friction within the mind. Anek chitta vibhranta moha jala samavrita. Krishna says, anek chitta vibhranta. Oh, I have to do this also, I have to do that also. The chitta, the consciousness is split over hundreds of things. And that's why there is friction. Should I do this, that? And that friction dissipates a lot of energy. But if we take time out to connect with Krishna, now Krishna is transcendental. There is ignorance, passion, goodness. These are like in a hierarchy. And above them is transcendence. So when we connect with Krishna through studying scripture, through chanting the holy names, through associating with devotees, that connection with the transcendental Lord elevates our consciousness, brings it to the mode of goodness. And in the mode of goodness, we can think clearly and act productively. So when we have to meditate, when we chant the holy names, actually that doesn't take away our productivity. That does not subtract from our productivity. It actually adds to our productivity. Why? Because it removes inner friction. So meditation removes inner friction, minimizes inner friction, and maximizes outer contribution. So we shouldn't feel that the time for chanting is taking away the time from my other things, which I have to do. No. It actually, if chanting takes away any time, it is our worry time and the waste time that is taken away. The worry and the waste, it's all the inner friction that goes on. So when that inner friction is minimized, then outer contribution is increased. So that when the demons and demigods both are pulling, so now it's not that if one person pulls more and the other person pulls less, then the churning will not happen properly. Both have to pull with similar energy. So that means both of them were pulling and both of them were working on an equal footing, but still it is said the demigods were working in goodness and the demons were working in passion, and as they kept pulling vigorously, then the churning went on and on, and gradually things started coming out of that churning. Now, so the Lord was actually doing everything, and now the Lord started acting in some extraordinary way. So how he acted, we will discuss in our next class. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.